Macmillan Audio presents Never Get Angry Again by David J. Lieberman. Read for you by Robert Fass. Introduction. Let's face it. If anger management techniques were effective, you wouldn't be reading this book. You've probably tried it all. Positive self-talk, punching a pillow, and reminding yourself that no good will come from getting angry. But the next time you feel your blood boiling, or you start to fly into a blind rage, see how well counting to 10 works for you. These clumsy attempts to maintain calmness are often futile, and sometimes emotionally draining. Anger management books typically feature these tried and not true methods, along with generic case studies, personal anecdotes, and bumper sticker slogans. The fact is, either something bothers us, causing anxiety, frustration, or anger, or it doesn't. Yes, our objective is to remain calm, but we can better accomplish this by not becoming agitated in the first place. When we fight the urge to blow up or melt down, we struggle against our own nature. The million-dollar question. What makes some people able to handle life's ups and downs, the twists and turns, bumps and bruises, with steadfast calm and composure, while others become incensed at the slightest insult, fall apart when facing a minor frustration, and blow out of proportion a mild disappointment? In a word, perspective. Imagine a small child playing with a toy that suddenly breaks. The child's whole world shatters, and she may respond by crying or becoming despondent, sad, or even angry. The child fails to appreciate, let alone recognize, all of the goodness in her life, that she is still being clothed, fed, loved, and taken care of, not to mention that an entire world exists outside of her own smaller world. The child's parents know the broken toy has no real relevance because they have perspective that the child lacks. Intellectually, we may recognize the unimportance and insignificance of whatever made us angry, yet the qualities that most of us strive to exemplify, such as objectivity and patience, are lost to frustration when, in a hurry, we encounter a checkout clerk with a trainee name tag staring at the cash register as if it were the cockpit of the space shuttle. We try to maintain our cool, but negative emotions surface and, once sparked, blaze. Now we face an uphill battle. Perspective lies at the crux of our response, and explains why we often feel irritated in the heat of the moment. After a few minutes, our anger subsides. A few hours later, we feel less angry, and in a few days, we wonder why we got so bothered in the first place. Time provides perspective, allowing us to see the situation with clarity. Likewise, as we grow and mature, we look back on our lives and realize that the summer camp we thought we must attend, the person we thought we must be friends with, or the office job we thought we must be offered, are no longer musts. Without perspective, we are forever like a child with a broken toy. The million-dollar answer. Mark Twain wrote, "Comedy is tragedy plus time." When we discover how to shift our perspective, we see today's events through the wiser, more balanced lens of tomorrow. Once we can recognize, in the moment, what really matters, we no longer need to force ourselves to remain calm. Our thoughts, feelings, and responses to any situation reshape themselves. Negative emotions like impatience, insecurity, and anger dissolve, not because we fight to control our emotions, but rather because we see the situation for what it really is. Of course, the question we still face is, how do we manage what is relevant? Yes, we know we shouldn't sweat the small stuff, and the only reason we do is that we lack perspective. But what about serious things, such as an illness, an injustice, or a trauma. Objectively, they are a big deal. To handle such crises with equanimity, we learn to pull back the lens even further, to find peace of mind regardless of the present or pending situation, and gain the presence of mind to take responsible action. Metaphorically speaking, typical anger management tools are akin to weed killer. You have to keep spraying all of the time, every time, to keep weeds from sprouting up. And no matter how vigilant you are, you'll still miss plenty, and you are left exhausted. Never Get Angry Again explains how to pull up weeds by their roots by looking at reality, ourselves, our lives, and our relationships with optimum perspective and emotional clarity. Through a comprehensive, holistic lens, we reveal and illuminate the causes and components of anger. These often include the gaping hole in our self-esteem due to a rotten, chaotic, or traumatic childhood, failing or failed relationships with those important to us, or living a life that lacks any real passion and joy, all fueled by an undercurrent of resentment as we wonder, where is God in all of this? Life is unfair, so either he's not in charge, he doesn't care, or he simply hates me. Not exactly self-esteem boosters or anger reducers. Certainly, even with the proper perspective, we can get caught up in the moment. High-intensity situations can provoke us to throw reason and rationale right out the window, as our emotions erupt before we even know what's happening. Yet it doesn't have to be like this. Should an errant weed pop up under extreme circumstances, you can still maintain complete control. By using cutting-edge research from the field of neuroplasticity, you can literally rewire your brain to automatically take over, even when you feel as if you're losing your mind. Now, as the saying goes, it takes two to tango. While a challenging life circumstance is one thing, the truth is, we wouldn't have to manage our anger if the people in our lives would manage their stupidity. Some folks, family, friends, and co-workers just push our buttons. In keeping with my penchant for the practical, you will learn step-by-step strategies to redraw boundaries, quash personality conflicts, and navigate difficult relationships to maintain or reclaim your sanity and eradicate a breeding ground for anger and frustration. Unmasking the enemy. Various techniques will help us succeed in controlling our anger, but they can't create awareness. Only the complete recognition of the apparatus and the foolishness and futility of anger will organically motivate us to keep our calm. For this reason, the first several sections of this book are descriptive. They explain the psychological dynamics of anger and of human nature. The latter sections are prescriptive, offering a range of psychological tools and techniques to win the ground war. But do not underestimate the power of understanding the enemy, anger. In any anger-provoking situation, we would love to ask ourselves, "Why am I really getting angry?" But of course we can't ask the question because we aren't thinking. We are only feeling. At that moment, nobody's home, and this is the fatal flaw in the tradition of anger management. However, when we wholly embrace the answer to this question with every fiber of our being before the situation arises, even when we lose perspective, the truth is baked into our very nature, and a calm and controlled response becomes second nature. The takeaway. Never Get Angry Again shows you how to permanently reorient your perspective. This will automatically take life's little things right off your radar, and the big stuff will never again manifest as fiery fits of uncontrollable anger or rage, but instead be instantly viewed through the lens of authentic acceptance. Discover the easy way to live anger-free and never get angry again, unless you want to. Part 1. The real reason you are so angry. 1. How perspective takes shape. Three forces within us are often at odds with one another: the soul, the ego, and the body. In short, the soul seeks to do what is right, the ego wants to be right and see itself in an optimal light, and the body just wants to escape from it all. When you make any decision in life, you can choose what feels good, you can choose what makes you look good, you can choose to do what is good or right. Doing what feels comfortable or enjoyable is a body drive. Excesses of this type are overeating or oversleeping. In effect, doing something merely because it feels good. When we act based on an ego drive, it can run the gamut from telling a joke at someone else's expense to making a lavish purchase that's beyond our means. When the ego reigns, we are not drawn to what is good, but to what makes us look good. We gain self-esteem only when we make responsible choices and do what is right. This is a soul-oriented, moral or conscience choice. Indeed, this is how self-esteem and self-control are intertwined. Emotional freedom doesn't mean doing whatever we feel like doing. Rather, it is doing what we truly want to do despite our desires at the moment. Imagine being on a diet and suddenly feeling the urge to eat a piece of chocolate. We fight the temptation, but eventually give in. Is this freedom or slavery? We felt like eating a piece of chocolate, and we did it. Did we like how we felt afterward? When we choose responsibly, we exercise self-control and increase our self-esteem. Do good to feel good. Each time we sacrifice what is responsible because we can't rise above the whims of an impulse or sell ourselves out to win the praise or approval of others, we lose self-respect. When we routinely succumb to immediate gratification or live to protect and project an image, we become angry with ourselves and ultimately feel empty inside. To quiet the unconscious gnawing that says, "I don't like me," we do whatever we can to feel good. We long to love ourselves, but instead we lose ourselves. Unable to invest in our own well-being, we spiral downward to the hollow, self-destructive refuge of activities that take us away from the pain: excessive eating, alcohol or drug abuse, and meaningless diversions and excursions. These ethereal delights mask our self-contempt, and because the happiness we seek instead results in greater pain, we descend further into despair and into hiding. Let's look at this another way. Have you ever tried to have a pleasant conversation with someone you didn't like, or to spend an hour or entire day with someone who gets on your nerves? It's almost painful. What if you lived with that person, and that person happened to be you? Everything in life is draining for the person who doesn't like who he has become. It's like working for a boss we despise. Even the most minor task triggers annoyance. Would we work hard for or invest in, let alone love and respect, an ungrateful, out-of-control person? You might try to quiet or distract him with pointless pursuits or endless entertainment, or even help him to get lost in a haze of abusive behaviors, as long as you don't have to face him, much less help him. To the extent that we don't love ourselves, our willingness to endure short-term pain for long-term gain wanes. Who wants to put in effort, enduring heartache and hardship for someone whom they don't even like? This mindset is understandable, but quite problematic. When we too often shirk our obligations and shun new opportunities, we lose more than we might imagine. Studies show that our tendency to avoid the pain inherent in taking responsibility for our lives is at the core of anger, and is central to nearly every emotional ailment, including anxiety, depression, and addiction. Perspective equals mental health. As our behavior becomes increasingly reckless and irresponsible, the ego swells to compensate for feelings of guilt, insecurity, and shame. Our perspective narrows, and we see more of the self and less of the world, which makes us ever more sensitive and unstable. To the degree that we refuse to accept the truth about ourselves and our lives, and overcome our laziness and fear of pain, the ego engages to protect us, and it shifts the blame elsewhere. In other words, if there is nothing wrong with me, then there must be something wrong with you. Or the world is unfair, or people are out to get me. Seedlings of neuroses and paranoia then take root. For us to remain unblemished in our own minds, we are forced to distort the world around us. And if our grasp on reality is flawed, then our adjustment to life will suffer. When a person loses his sanity, the ability to see, accept, and respond to his world, it means he has lost all perspective. Emotional instability, the seat of anger, is fundamentally a lack of clarity, the degree to which the ego infects us. With a responsible, soul-oriented choice, self-esteem increases, the ego shrinks, perspective widens, reality is undistorted, we see and accept the truth, even when difficult or painful, which leads to positive emotional health and acting responsibly. With an irresponsible, ego-oriented, or overindulgent body choice, self-esteem decreases, the ego expands, perspective narrows, reality is distorted, we are unable or unwilling to see and accept truth when difficult or painful, which leads to negative mental health and acting irresponsibly. 2. Angry with ourselves, angry at the world. None of us wants to admit, even to ourselves, that we are selfish or lazy, much less a failure or flawed. The ego is thus equipped with an elaborate array of shields and buffers, defense mechanisms, to thwart the harshness of reality. Of course, instead of protecting us rather than itself, these defense mechanisms lead to increased instability and insecurity. And the wider the chasm between the truth and our ability to accept it, the more fragile our emotional health becomes. In Reality Therapy, Dr. William Glasser writes, "In their unsuccessful effort to fulfill their needs, no matter what behavior they choose, all patients have a common characteristic. They all deny the reality of the world around them. Whether it is a partial denial or the total blotting out of all of reality of the chronic backward patient in the state hospital, the denial of some or all of reality is common to patients. Therapy will be successful when they are able to give up denying the world and recognize that reality exists, but that they must fulfill their needs within its framework. Our ego colors the world so that we remain untarnished. Before we airbrush reality, however, a collision occurs in the unaccessed caverns of our unconscious between truth and falsehood, producing the psychological phenomenon cognitive dissonance, the feeling of uncomfortable tension and stress that comes from holding two contradictory ideas simultaneously. It is the byproduct of tension between the soul and ego. When we choose to either accept reality or reduce dissonance by any number of defense mechanisms, the most common of these are avoidance, denial, or justification. Shopaholics are often a good example of cognitive dissonance. Though cognizant of the dangers associated with this addiction, shopaholics may reduce the tension by A. avoiding the issue, that is, putting all expenses on a credit card and not focusing on the money spent, B. denying that they are addicted and cannot stop, that it is as if their vehicle drives into the nearest mall of its own volition, C. rationalizing their shopping habits, if I don't spend time out of the house, I will go off my diet, or the healthiest and most difficult, D, accepting the truth and taking steps to get the needed help. Drew Weston and his colleagues, 2006, found that the reasoning areas of the brain virtually shut down when a person is confronted with dissonant information and the emotion circuits of the brain light up happily when consonance is restored. As Weston put it, people twirl the cognitive kaleidoscope until the pieces fall into the pattern they want to see, and then the brain repays them by activating circuits involved in pleasure. It seems that the feeling of cognitive dissonance can literally make your brain hurt. That's why the ego seizes any opportunity to reconcile internal conflict. The following anecdote illustrates this process, particularly when our self-concept is on the line. A man woke up one day convinced that he was a zombie. When he told his wife he was a zombie, she tried to talk him out of this outrageous opinion. "You are not a zombie," she said. "I am a zombie," he answered. "What makes you think you're a zombie?" she asked rhetorically. "Don't you think zombies know they are zombies?" he answered with great sincerity. His wife realized she wasn't getting anywhere, so she called his mother and told her what was going on. His mother tried to help. "I'm your mother. Wouldn't I know if I gave birth to a zombie?" "You didn't," he explained. "I became a zombie later." "I didn't raise my son to be a zombie, or especially to think he is a zombie," his mother pleaded. "Nonetheless, I am a zombie," he said, unmoved by his mother's appeal to his identity and sense of guilt. Later that day, his wife called a psychiatrist. The receptionist gave the wife an emergency appointment, and within the hour, the husband was in the psychiatrist's office. "So you think you're a zombie?" the psychiatrist asked. "I know I am a zombie," the man said. "Tell me, do zombies bleed?" the psychiatrist asked. "Of course not," said the man. "Zombies are the living dead. They don't bleed." The man felt a little annoyed at the psychiatrist's patronizing question. "Well, watch this," said the psychiatrist, picking up a pin. He took the man's finger and made a tiny pinprick. The man looked at his finger with great amazement and said nothing for 3 or 4 minutes. "What do you know?" the man finally said. "Zombies do bleed." The mask that doesn't come off. Denying reality comes with a price. Exhausted and on edge, our ego edits our world to eliminate anything that will hurt or reveal us, either to ourselves or to others. Preoccupied with potential threats to our self-image, we are on constant guard. We hide behind a carefully crafted facade, and the identity that we build to shield ourselves soon becomes a shell encasing us. Over time, we fall into a hellish gap of unrealized potential. Our true self weakens, and we feel hollow inside. We no longer live for ourselves. We exist only to protect our image, the ego. This includes all of the games we play and the masks we wear to show the rest of the world what we believe is the necessary persona. We may not even realize how much of our attitude and behavior, indeed our values and beliefs, we style to avoid self-reflection, to compensate for self-hatred, and to project an image that betrays neither. In the exchange, we lose ourselves, contorting to the rules demanded by others to win their praise. Unsurprisingly, we never feel truly satiated. When we don't love ourselves, we can't give love, and we can't feel loved. Even when the supply of affection and adulation is plentiful, we experience a different reality, an endless flow of tainted love. Ultimately, we remain empty and angry inside. Imagine pouring water into a cup that has no bottom. As you pour in the water, the cup feels and looks full. As long as the cup is constantly being filled, we feel content. But the minute someone stops filling it, with undivided attention, respect, or adoration, the cup quickly empties, and we are left as thirsty as ever. A shattered cup will never be full, and our thirst can never be quenched, no matter how much we receive. King Solomon, the wisest of men, wrote, "A lacking on the inside can never be satisfied with something from the outside." People who seek self-esteem from external sources can never be truly content. They are the very epitome of a bottomless pit. We are hardwired to love ourselves, but when we can't nourish ourselves through good choices and thus gain self-respect, we turn to the rest of the world to feed us. We make a desperate but futile attempt to convert their love and respect into feelings of self-worth. Our ever-shifting self-image becomes a direct reflection of the world around us. Our mood is raw and vulnerable to every fleeting glance and passing comment. We erroneously and frantically believe, if they care about me, then maybe I'm worth something, and then maybe I can love me. Yet it doesn't work, and herein lies the basis for many failed relationships. When we lack self-esteem, we push away the very people we so desperately want in our lives because we can't fathom why anyone would love someone as unlovable as ourselves. And whatever affection or kindness forces its way through to us, we hardly embrace it. Such overtures don't serve to comfort, but rather to confuse us. And the ego's mandate is clear: reject others before they have a chance to reject us. To compound matters, the less self-control we have, the more desperately we manipulate events and people around us, especially those closest to us, either overtly or passive-aggressively. We intuit that self-control fosters self-respect, so when we cannot control ourselves, we need to feel as if we are in control of someone, something, anything, to feel a sense of power, the intricacies of which are further detailed in Chapter 4. Low self-esteem can thus trigger a powerful unconscious desire to usurp authority, to overstep bounds, and to mistreat those who care about us. When we don't like who we are, we cannot help but become angry with ourselves. Then we take it out on the world around us and on the people who care most about us. 3. Isolated from ourselves, disconnected from others. For better or worse, our emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being feasts on and fuels the quality of our relationships, past and present. The previous chapter explained that people with low self-esteem have difficulty receiving love. Indeed, they cannot easily give love either. We can only give what we have. We give love, we give respect. If we don't have it, what do we have to give? Give and take. Love is limitless. A parent does not love her second child less because she already has one child. She loves each child, gives to each child, and does not run out of love. Compare this to someone who acquires a work of art that he loves. Over time, his fascination with the piece wanes, and when he acquires a new work, all of his attention, affection, and joy are redirected from the old art to the new art, because, in truth, he does not care for his art. He cares for himself, and his art makes him happy. He is not giving to his art gives to him, and so he takes. A person may say, "I love cookies." He doesn't. He enjoys eating cookies. If he truly loved cookies, then he would keep them out of sight and safe. Love is not selfish. Moving to a more profound scenario, it should come as no surprise that anger is easily triggered when we focus on our own pain and how difficult life is for us. For instance, when faced with a present or impending loss, the egocentric person grieves less for the other and more for himself. His loss, his guilt, his woe. The less the ego is involved, the less stuck we will become, because normal feelings of sadness are processed healthily rather than suppressed, masked, or channeled away from the healing process. Let's consider the four stages of grief: denial, anger, depression, and acceptance. The first three stages are ego-based. Only when we loosen the ego's grip can we move toward acceptance. Herein lies the often blurred distinction between lust and love. Lust is the opposite of love. When we lust after someone or something, our interest is purely selfish. We want to take, to feel complete. When we love, however, we focus on how we can give, and we do so happily and eagerly. When someone we love is in pain, we feel pain. When someone we lust after is in pain, however, our thoughts go to how it will affect us in terms of our own inconvenience or discomfort. What does this mean for me, not you? When a person suffers from low self-esteem, he takes what he needs in an attempt to make himself feel whole, which is why the last person you want trying to love you is someone who doesn't love himself. This person cannot really love. He can only control and take. The more self-esteem we have, the more complete we are. Receiving, after all, is a natural and reciprocal consequence of giving. When we only take, however, to fill a constant void, we are left empty and are forced to continue taking in a futile quest to feel fulfilled, which only reinforces our dependency and exhausts us emotionally and physically. Since self-esteem endows us with the ability to both give and to receive, some people with low self-esteem may have great difficulty accepting favors and expressing gratitude because needing or receiving help can trigger feelings of inadequacy. If the discomfort is severe, he may develop hostile feelings toward the very person extending the offering because the giver brings increased awareness to his insecurities and shortcomings. Through this paradigm, we learn how to tell whether someone has high or low self-esteem. It is reflected in how he treats himself and others. A person who lacks self-esteem may indulge in things to satisfy only his own desires, and he will not treat others particularly well, a product of an arrogant mentality. Alternatively, this person may cater to others because he craves their approval and respect, but he does not take care of his own needs, a product of the doormat mentality. Only someone who has higher self-esteem can give responsibly, love and respect, to both himself and others. Empathy versus sympathy. This brings us to another marked distinction between sympathy and empathy. The former means that we feel pity for a person's situation, but we are disinclined to exert ourselves to alleviate his plight. A person may be very sensitive to the suffering of others, but if he merely sympathizes, he is consumed with his own pain and is then motivated primarily to reduce his own suffering, usually by means of escapism and indulgence, rather than help the person who actually feels pain. He often wishes he were unaware of the sorrow around him so as not to suffer as a result. The typical characteristics of the egocentric mentality are arrogance and bravado, but even a highly sensitive person who is seemingly void of ego can also be self-centered and selfish. He is absorbed in his own pain, filled with self-pity, and he can't feel anyone else's pain while drowning in his own. Such a person experiences no real connection to anyone outside of himself, despite his seemingly noble nature. Without genuine humility, he will not, cannot, burden himself unless he receives a larger payout in the form of acceptance or approval. His taking is disguised as giving. His fear is dressed up as love. He may also be motivated by the need to assuage feelings of guilt or inadequacy, yet still, his aim is to reduce his own suffering, not someone else's. Empathy, by comparison, is the capacity to share another's emotions and feel his pain, rather than to merely feel sorry for him. The person with empathy feels grateful for knowing about others' troubles because he genuinely wants to alleviate their suffering. Moral development, rather than just moral thinking, is what moves a person to altruistic behavior. In fact, sociopaths have been shown to possess excellent moral reasoning, but feel no need to act befittingly. This requires empathy. Parenthetically, the ease with which we rise above our own problems and shift attention to the welfare of another is a reliable marker of emotional health. While we all are, to some extent, self-absorbed, particularly when we struggle with personal challenges, the intensity and duration are revealing. Almost anyone can be warm, kind, and generous when he is in a positive mood. However, a true indicator of emotional health is when a person can respond to the needs of another with care and patience, even while in a low emotional state or under physical distress. A person who is not self-centered feels humility and a connection to others. The wall of I am me and he is he is broken down, and where there is no ego, there is connection, a bond. For this reason, we naturally feel empathy more easily for children, the elderly, the sick, or even animals, because we see their vulnerability via their ego-free appearance. They look the part. We experience this in our own lives in different ways to different degrees. A person bangs into us on a busy street and we turn around, annoyed, only to find that he's blind or otherwise handicapped and is simply trying to get past us. We see his limitation, we feel for him, our heart goes out to him, and our anger dissipates. Or maybe a coworker spills coffee on your desk and dashes away. You're about to walk into her office and pounce, only to learn that her child is sick in the hospital. Anger cannot exist where there is no separation, no I to get in the way. But when we are self-focused, the ego cuts the cord. Fundamentally, anger is a disconnection, to avoid pain, to inflict pain. To be part of someone's life, we need to create a space for that person. If one is too self-absorbed, there is no room for anyone else, and such a person is trapped in the tomb of his own suffering, because his capacity to connect with others is strained, if not altogether severed. Physical isolation, or even simply being ignored, is painful. In fact, studies show that feeling alone or experiencing loneliness, more than any other factor, causes extreme stress and an overall weakening of the immune system. The pain of isolation is not just a metaphor. Functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI scans, reveal that two areas of the brain where we process physical pain, the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex and the anterior insula, become activated when we experience feelings of social rejection. The lower the self-esteem, the weaker the connection to our true selves, the soul, and to the true selves of others. As such, our ability to give love and to receive love erodes. We suffer, our relationships suffer, everyone suffers. Smoke and mirrors. We should note that people often mistake confidence for self-esteem, but the two are quite different. Confidence is how effective we feel within a specific area or situation, while self-esteem is defined as how much we recognize our inherent worth and feel deserving of happiness and good fortune. Self-esteem is shaped by the quality of our choices rather than by the assets at our disposal. A person who attempts to fortify his self-image by taking pride in a specific trait may exhibit signs of high self-esteem to the untrained eye, but in fact, such an individual often suffers from low self-esteem because all he has is an inflated ego. When a person suffers from very low self-esteem, it doesn't matter how accomplished he appears. He depends on everyone and everything to boost his faltering self-image. The research is clear. A person's inflated sense of self does not derive from self-esteem, but from self-loathing. Don't fall into the trap of believing that a person with an inflated ego likes himself. Ego and self-esteem are inversely related. No matter how much a person appears to be happy with himself, if he is egocentric, that person suffers with feelings of inferiority. This statement is not conjecture, but a law of human nature. It is psychological math. 4. Step right up and choose your reality. Each circumstance we encounter is like a blank book until we write the script with our thoughts. For instance, when someone acts rudely toward us, it doesn't mean anything. This person's words or deeds cause us to feel bad about ourselves because of our self-image. What does his opinion really have to do with our self-worth? Nothing. But that's just what the ego does. It makes everything about us. The greater our self-esteem, the less quick we are to take offense, Because when we love ourselves, A, we don't assume that someone's actions mean he doesn't respect us, and B, even if we do come to that conclusion, we aren't angered, because we don't need his respect in order to respect ourselves. We often unconsciously evaluate a situation to determine how personally we should take it, and thus how offended we should feel. For example, a car cuts us off on the road, and we are curious to see what the driver looks like. Why? Based on the driver's appearance, we try to determine if the action was deliberate. An elderly man wearing a gray fedora and driving a 1983 Oldsmobile would not enrage us as much as a young man smoking a cigarette with music blaring from his car's open windows. Most of us would assume that the older gentleman simply didn't see our car, while the young man did it to us on purpose, because he doesn't respect us and doesn't care. Do you appreciate the absurdity of this? We get cut off on the road, and then we speed up to see what the offending driver looks like so we can decide how angry we should become. Whatever the situation or circumstance, the question we ask ourselves is always the same. What does this mean? That's what anger comes down to. It's not only that you take it personally. Rather, it's the belief that this person treated me this way because there's something wrong with me, something broken or flawed. As we discussed in Chapter 2, if you don't love and respect yourself, then you can't imagine why anyone else would have positive feelings toward you. I don't like me, so you must not like me. We connect the dots of someone else's behavior to arrive at a place of hurt. We assume that the person has treated us this way because they know the truth. This frightful thought makes us question our self-worth. Maybe I deserve this. We often experience more pain when we feel disrespected by a smart, wealthy, or attractive person. Via the ego, we believe that this individual has more value, and so his treatment of us is of greater significance. Indeed, our relationship to the person also shapes the impact. If a crazed person starts screaming at us, we will likely be minimally affected by the encounter. But what if it's a close friend, a respected colleague, or a loved one? Why are we more inclined to feel hurt and prone to become angry? Because this person knows us inside and out, the good, the bad, and the ugly. This can cause us to more easily question our self-worth. This person really knows me. Maybe there's something to it. The flaw in this thinking is a corrupted correlation between a person's knowledge of us and his treatment of us. Just because someone knows you well, it doesn't make him healthy. If a person has 100% self-esteem, speaking theoretically, he would approach the entire world with love and respect. When conversing with a rude person, for example, he would be filled with empathy. His singular thought would be, how much pain must this person be in to treat someone as wonderful as me so poorly? Again, we can only give what we have. We give love, we give respect. How someone behaves toward you is a reflection of his own feelings of self-worth and has nothing to do with your intrinsic worth, unless you, the ego, decide to make it about you. Likewise, when you're in a good mood, brimming with transitory feelings of confidence and control, does it mean that others are suddenly worthier of your respect and kindness? No one has changed but you. As our mood sours, we become emotionally stingy and give respect to those we need. We are not really giving anything, though, but rather taking, masquerading as giving. It's not me, it's you. In the previous chapter, we explained that when we know a person's limitations, animosity is diffused, because once we see their vulnerability and fragility, we don't make his problem our problem. And while the more arrogant a person appears to be on the outside, the more weak and helpless he feels on the inside, it is we who determine whether we will see beyond the facade. Once our ego is deployed, we become fearful. The knee-jerk conclusion is, how dare he? And the fuse is lit. If, however, we are primed to observe the basis for his behavior, his feelings of inadequacy and insecurity, then we remain anger-free, if not filled with empathy, then at least with pity. As long as we are alert to the pain of the other person, the entire interaction is automatically reframed, and we will not feel pained because we will not be in pain. But the moment we become self-focused, we will draw the inevitable conclusion that this treatment is because we are less rather than he feels less, and that's scary. That's painful. It's not the situation that determines how you feel, but the meaning that we attach to it. And that meaning is always based on one thing, how we feel about ourselves. There is an event and an emotional response, but in between those is an intellectual process where we assign a meaning to what is happening. The instant you choose to take it personally, yes, it's a choice, you'll be fighting against your nature. Imagine that you're at a party, and someone starts screaming at you for being a lying, no-good thief and hurls a string of accusations at you. The music stops and the crowd stares. You're feeling mortified until he calls you by the wrong name. Realizing that this is a case of mistaken identity and everyone now knows it, you move from humiliation to relief as your focus shifts from yourself to this poor guy and how embarrassed he's going to be the moment he learns the truth. In all interactions, if your ego is out of the way, then you know that he's got the wrong person. It's not you, unless you make it about you. While it's true that he may see you as less, that doesn't make you less. But if you feel less, then it does make you angry. The story we sell ourselves. When someone close to us, our spouse, for example, does something we don't like, the behavior itself is one thing, but that is not what drives our anger. Rather, it is the belief that our spouse's behavior means that he or she doesn't love us enough, really care about us enough, or have enough respect for us. Let's parse out the what from the why to see how our ego so easily leads us astray. If you got upset with your spouse, who then apologized profusely, asked for forgiveness, and then did everything that he could to make it up to you, would you have a harder time maintaining the anger? Understandably, you would still object to the behavior. But should your spouse take full responsibility and convey that his failings are not due to a lack of love or appreciation for you, anger is harder to sustain. The reality has not changed, but the meaning that you assigned to the behavior has, and that changes how you feel about the behavior. Certainly we can see how this may apply to minor lapses or offenses, but I suspect we can conjure up a scenario or two that might have us fuming mad at the situation itself, ego or no ego. In part 4, we will explore more deeply how to uproot anger even in the case of a highly significant event or severe breach of trust. But still on this subject, let's assume that our spouse does not have respect for us. Fine. Again, we ask ourselves a single question. What does this mean? It may mean that our spouse lacks self-esteem and thus cannot effectively give and receive love and respect. It may mean that we have to look in the mirror at our own conduct and ask ourselves, have I been kind and loving to my spouse? Has my behavior played a role in his attitude toward me? Whatever conclusion we draw, the one that is never accurate is the ego-based. I deserve this because there is something wrong with me. Our conduct may have been wrong, but this does not mean that we are bad and undeserving of love and happiness. If we believe this to be true at a conscious level, then we live out our lives in victim mode, for this is the treatment that we deserve. If we harbor this belief unconsciously, then we become enraged at every perceived or genuine lack of respect. Moreover, we will be looking for signs that we are not worthy of love and respect. If we don't find them, we will convince ourselves that we have by reading into things and jumping to conclusions. This is, in fact, at the core of jealous thinking. I am not worthy of you, so you must not be faithful to me. If this is my belief, then I become hyper-tuned in to anything that will fortify my position, and I will see what I need to in order to prove myself right. I will connect dots to complete the narrative so that it tells my story. Anger, the fine print. The intricacies of anger are often simplified to the point of being incomplete. To say that we become angry because we are scared or in pain is like saying that a lamp works because the light switch is flipped on. True enough, but the underlying connection, electricity, is left out of the equation. Pain in and of itself does not lead to anger, neither does fear. Mountain climbing and crossword puzzles can be grueling and excruciating. A roller coaster or horror movie can be terrifying. And yet these can also be exhilarating and enjoyable. However, an 18-wheeler veering into your lane, your small child running into the street, a careless person banging into you at work, or your boss yelling at you may very well provoke anger. What is the difference in these scenarios? Control. What activates anger is an emotional or physical pain that we cannot control. Fear comes into play because fear itself is emotionally painful, with fear of the unknown, which carries a complete lack of control, having the potential to bring the greatest pain. Opposite sides of the same coin. Unpredictable or uncontrollable pain brings fear, and fear that we cannot predict or control is painful. Since it is the ego that seeks control, even emotional pain in proper context, widened ego-free perspective, is diluted. A close friend receives tragic news and makes a scene in a public place, but feelings of embarrassment take a back seat to empathy over their sorrow. A loved one lashes out at us in anger because we caused him hurt, but rather than feel rejected, we feel for him and seek to allay his fears. The shame game. Human beings experience two primary emotions, love, which is soul-based, and fear, which is ego-based. All positive emotions stem from love, and all negative emotions stem from fear. The fear of isolation, because we are unfit to be loved. Which brings us to shame. Shame is our conscience, the voice of the soul that says, I am less because of my actions. It is the painful belief that our behavior makes us unworthy of love and undeserving of acceptance, and by extension, all that we love is neither safe nor secure. This pain of legitimate shame is to alert us that we have fallen below our potential. In accepting responsibility, we not only cancel the emotional debt, but we receive the benefit of enhanced self-esteem, and with it, the capacity to love and be loved, as well as a host of emotional dividends, including trust in our future welfare. See Chapter 11 for elaboration. However, when we are confronted by either circumstance or conscience and deny accountability, we will, to varying degrees and levels of consciousness, acquire a stain of shame, because we cannot lie to our deepest selves. Part 4 shows the process to free ourselves from shame and restore our feelings of self-worth to pristine condition. Therein lies the origin of anger. As the ego compensates for feelings of unresolved shame, we experience a counterfeit shame. I am less if you think I am less. Feeling rejected in any way, embarrassed, criticized, unwanted, mocked, and the like, is excruciatingly painful and intensely feared because it feels to us, the ego, the false self, like genuine shame. The egocentric psyche translates any rejection to mean that I am inadequate. I will not be safe and accepted because I am unworthy of love and undeserving of good. A further aberration explains misplaced shame, which is rooted in the corrupted belief that says, I am responsible for the behavior of others. In which case, we are never blameless for whatever is done to us because we are a co-conspirator, both victim and abuser. In chapter 14, we explain that because children are egocentric by nature, it is normal for them to ascribe a failure within themselves as the reason behind the behavior of others. Therefore, if we as children grew up believing that we were never good enough to merit our parents' love and approval, or we are mistreated, held to unrealistic expectations, or forced to assume responsibilities that weren't ours, shame, the feeling that we have failed, fallen below our potential, is imprinted. We all transition to adulthood having absorbed some shame, which is why we feel ashamed for inherent flaws and faults, which we neither caused nor contributed to, and, of course, that we all have. And the more damaging the childhood, the greater the ego and accompanying shame. The ego is on the lookout for any situation that calls into question our worth, fearful that we are not lovable and may be rejected. Hence, the opposite of control, feeling vulnerable or even being stared at, let alone being disrespected or ridiculed, can send the egocentric psyche into overdrive. It becomes clear then why relationships, particularly with those closest to us, can result in unrelenting anger. It sets off so many emotional triggers. Take a simple scenario. A child does not listen to a parent. Guilt, maybe I've done a poor job parenting. Disrespect, how dare he not listen to me? Rejection, he doesn't love me. Embarrassment, if others are around, what do they think of me? Fear, what's going to become of him? What will become of our relationship? Injustice, after all I've done for him. Whenever there is a threat to our emotional or physical selves, the lower our self-esteem in general, and how much the uncomfortable truth hits a raw nerve and affects our self-image in particular, the more fearful we become of feeling that pain. As a result, our need to exert control surges. Authentic control is actuated when we rise above our nature and exercise self-control, thus rendering the fear/pain mechanism inert. Anger is the illusion of control, because physiologically, the release of the neurotransmitter noradrenaline and the hormone adrenaline increases awareness, energy, and strength. Emotionally, anger redirects our attention away from the fear/pain, which also mimics the sensation that we have seized control. The reality, of course, is that we spiral out of control and become weaker with each intense anger-driven thought or action. Our personality will dictate how our anger manifests, explained further in chapter 21, and mirrors the fight-or-flight response to a physical threat. Assertive-aggressive, fight. We come out fighting, attempting to control the situation overtly. Passive-aggressive, flight. Anger leaks out in more subtle ways. Unable to confront directly, we seek control stealthily. Surrender or suppression, flight. We are unable to consciously acknowledge our anger, so we control it by either A, telling ourselves that we are not worthy of asserting ourselves, or B, suppressing our emotions and telling ourselves that we are not angered to begin with. Immobilization, freeze. Feeling powerless, we close down to insulate ourselves from the pain. I can avoid, I can shut out the world. I will be safe. I will be in control. The fight-or-flight response is a physiological reaction to a perceived threat and is triggered whether the danger is real or imagined. For example, whether we see a bear in the woods or believe that we see one, the response is the same. The sympathetic nervous system activates the adrenal gland, which releases adrenaline, noradrenaline, and cortisol into the bloodstream, and reroutes the threat from the prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, to the amygdala, the fear and anxiety response center. The moment, however, that we realize that there is no bear, the response disengages, because the danger no longer exists. Likewise, becoming aware that we are not experiencing shame, but its counterfeit, neutralizes the threat. We have nothing to fear and no need to exert control because the pain is not real. We are not in danger. We are already safe. Part 2. The Cost of Living, The Price of Escaping. 5. Why Smart People Do Dumb Things. A man known in medical literature as Eliot became a famous figure in brain research when he suffered damage to the frontal lobes of his brain as the result of a tumor. Although he enjoyed a superior IQ, he would become lost in triviality and foolish pursuits. After giving Eliot a battery of tests, his physician, leading scientist Dr. Antonio Damasio, realized that the man was incapable of emotional expression. Although intellectually he could weigh the pros and cons of any decision, when it came time to actually decide, he was completely lost. Damasio states, his decision-making landscape was hopelessly flat. In his book, Descartes' Error, Damasio describes trying to set up an appointment with Eliot. I suggested two alternative dates, both in the coming month and just a few days apart from each other. The patient pulled out his appointment book and began consulting the calendar. The behavior that ensued, which was witnessed by several investigators, was remarkable. For the better part of a half hour, the patient enumerated reasons for and against each of the two dates: previous engagements, proximity to other engagements, possible meteorological conditions, virtually anything that one could think about concerning a simple date. He was walking us through a tiresome cost-benefit analysis, an endless outlining and fruitless comparison of options and possible consequences. It took enormous discipline to listen to all of this without pounding on the table and telling him to stop. Indeed, it did stop. All it took was for Damasio to interrupt the man's deliberations and assign him a date and a time to return. Without hesitating, the patient said, "That's fine," and went on his way. Vulcans need not apply. When we have no drive to mobilize our passion, nothing reinforces the intellectual process that moves us in one direction or the other. This is one primary function that emotions serve: to energize our behavior and motivate us to take action. We need emotions, but when we lead with our feelings, our intellect then fortifies a distorted conclusion. To choose wisely, we must first see clearly through the lens of the intellect, and afterward align our emotions, preferably positive ones. A person is always better off identifying with the love of the virtue for which he is fighting than acting out of anger, which is always ego-based. Meaning that focusing on our passion for what is right, rather than on our disdain for what is wrong, will help us to see more clearly and to act more responsibly, because we are not blinded by outrage. This is not a pacifist approach, but one that allows for an optimum response. No one ever walked away from an argument and thought, "I wish I had gotten angrier. I would have been able to handle myself so much better." Later in the chapter, we will see how anger robs us of our intelligence, the faculty to process reality. But first we will see how it distorts our ability to see clearly. Wisdom is a function of both intellectual and emotional clarity. To the degree that our ego is engaged, we unconsciously distort or consciously ignore reality and gravitate toward the less responsible choice. Therefore, in any given situation, it's quite possible for a smart person to make an astonishingly poor decision, while his less intelligent counterpart will make the wiser, more prudent choice. Self-esteem and emotional health, aka wisdom, which is synonymous with an expanded perspective, go hand in hand. Intelligence, however, is largely unrelated to either self-esteem or emotional well-being. An overweight diabetic with low self-esteem knows she shouldn't eat chocolate cake for dinner, but she eats it anyway. Her low self-esteem is directing the choice she makes. In that moment, she's more interested in the chocolate cake than in her physical health. The hallmark of emotional maturity is the ability to delay gratification, to bear some pain now, or to give up a lower-level pleasure in exchange for a greater pleasure later, or to avoid a small pain from becoming a bigger pain. Intelligence does not make a person rational. Intelligence can only put us in the driver's seat with a map in hand. Wisdom opens our eyes to see what we wish would not exist, to accept with grace, and to respond with clarity and confidence. Self-esteem and delaying gratification. Self-esteem stimulates the desire to invest in ourselves and provides the energy for self-discipline. When our self-esteem is low, our interest and attention shift from long-term to immediate gratification. If it feels good, do it, regardless of the consequences. The most appealing choice will be the one that satisfies our immediate urges. We resemble the child who would rather have one lollipop now than five lollipops tomorrow. Five lollipops, of course, is the better bargain, but the child doesn't think about that. His focus is short-term, shallow, and narrow. He is occupied with the here and now, often forsaking his long-term self-interest, let alone the bigger picture, or even more so, the needs of others. It is significant to note the landmark experiment dubbed the Marshmallow Test, which looked into the ability of children to delay gratification and the resulting long-term correlation and consequences. Conducted at Stanford University, researchers gave a marshmallow to each child participating in the experiment with the following offer: either eat this one marshmallow right away, or wait a short while and receive an additional marshmallow. The researcher then left the room, and the child was alone with a marshmallow in front of him. In follow-ups a decade later, the children who delayed their gratification were more successful both academically and socially. Analysis concluded that they reported fewer pathological symptoms, including obsessive-compulsive patterns, depression, anxiety, hostile anger, phobic anxiety, paranoid ideation, and psychoticism, and exhibited higher self-acceptance and self-esteem. Angry people behave stupidly. Research finds self-regulation failure is central to nearly all the personal and social problems that currently plague the modern developed world. These problems include drug addiction and abuse, alcoholism, smoking, crime and violence, underachievement in schools, gambling, personal debt and credit card abuse, lack of financial savings, anger, and hostility. Among the most important triggers of self-regulation failure, in plain English, what makes us lose self-control and give in to our impulses, is anger. The following excerpt from a benchmark research paper summarizes the unsurprising range of self-destructive behaviors that anger spawns. When people become upset, they sometimes act aggressively, spend too much money, engage in risky behavior, comfort with alcohol, drugs, or food, and fail to pursue important life goals. Anger is related to relapse for a number of addictive behaviors, such as alcoholism, gambling, and drug addiction, and increased eating by chronic dieters and greater smoking intensity by smokers. Anger releases a stress hormone called cortisol. Long-term elevated cortisol levels have a detrimental effect on us, both physically and mentally. Specifically, cortisol damages cells in the hippocampus and results in impaired learning. In the short term, cortisol interferes with our ability to think and process information. Or, to put it another way, getting angry actually makes us dumb. Biochemically, anger, as we know, initiates the fight-or-flight response and the production of adrenaline, which reroutes blood flow away from the brain and, with it, oxygen, which further muddles our thinking. Wisdom is one of the most powerful byproducts of emotional health, and it gives us the capacity and fortitude to see the situation objectively and then respond calmly and logically, rather than allowing anger to corrupt our observation, assessment, judgment, and conduct.